Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Road Show.
Okay. Welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're glad you're listening in with us.
Yes, we are. Sorry, we're having...
We're practicing sign language, all kinds of stuff's going on.
Yes.
You should really... This is probably the most entertaining part of the show is between the hours when we're trying to get one person out and the new person in. There's all this stuff going on.
The costume changes.
Oh, yeah.
It's so, because Hino's like Cher. He changes every break.
Every segment, I change
every
into a
break,
new outfit.
He changes.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
He's about to put that one... Remember that video on the battleship? Never mind.
Yeah.
Hey, we're glad you're hanging here with us. We'd love for you to join in the conversation. Log on to facebook.com/TheMusicRowShow and chat alongside with us.
Absolutely. You can also find us on Twitter, of course, @TheMusicRowShow, and on Instagram, @TheMusicRowShow. See how we kind of did that? It's just all @TheMusicRowShow.
What's an Instagram?
I'll tell you later.
Are we
it's kind of like Western Union, but not.
Are we doing the tumblering? Because I'm all about the Tumblr, I hear.
Yeah,
the Snapchatting.
Yeah.
Because I'm all over it. Hino, tell us who this fine gentleman is joining our studio.
I don't think I can anymore because you just wore me out.
Well, that's okay. I'll do it instead. Remember that song he wrote?
About that guy at the place doing the thing? Uh-huh. Love that one. Yeah. We are thrilled, actually, to be visiting with Grammy Award-winning songwriter and performer Carl Jackson is here with us now. In addition to being a songwriter with a list of cuts about a mile long for artists like Dolly Parton and Ricky Skaggs, Doyle Lawson, Rhonda Vincent, Brad Paisley, Carl's also a very accomplished bluegrass instrumentalist and recording artist who's played on so many albums we don't even have time to list them all. We'd run out of time for the hour. But he's also produced many albums, not only for other people, but for himself. Some of the many awards Carl has won include Grammy for Best Bluegrass Album, 91 Spring Training. It was a great album. Grammy for Best Country Album in 2003 for Livin', Lovin', and Losin'.
Livin', Lovin', and Louvin.
Louvin.
Livin', Lovin', Losin'. Songs of the Louvin'.
Aha!
There you go. Oh.
Wah, wah.
Oh, I would hate when I'm
correction
wrong.
Fail.
Wah, wah.
Anyway, he's also won several IBMA awards over the years, and we're just thrilled to say Carl Jackson, welcome to the Music Row Show.
It's great to be here. Wow. That was quite a buildup. Wow.
Yeah.
Are you tired?
It's all
yet?
Downhill from here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. One thing that you did leave out, he's the third piece of the trifecta.
That's right.
Because we've had Larry Cordell on the show.
Yes.
We've had Jerry Sally on the show, and you guys do an awful lot of music together. So you've been the elusive third piece of that puzzle. So
I was holding out.
You were. You were playing hard to get.
The contract negotiations were endless. Endless, I tell you.
Never get the oil change.
Yeah. And notice, no M&Ms in the studio. So we did read the writers.
So, Carl, first off, thanks for being here. And
glad to be here.
Now, most of us learn to strum guitars as teenagers, mainly to get girls. That's just the true fact of life.
What do you mean, most of us?
Well, you know, most of us. But you started a lot earlier than teenager. I mean, you were a young guy, and with the banjo, no less.
Yeah, well, see, that wards girls away.
So I was about to say, girls were obviously not the motivating factor.
Not at eight, but, you know, I started playing guitar pretty quickly after that.
Yeah.
So what were your motivating driving forces at that age?
Oh, gosh. I grew up... my dad and my two uncles had a little bluegrass band and had a local radio show on WLSM radio in Louisville, Mississippi. And I just grew up loving the music. My dad, oh gosh, there is nothing in the world he loves more than bluegrass music.
Yeah.
And he very much wanted me to play. And it was just... I give credit to God. A lot of it was just born in me. I really wanted. I dreamed about. Playing music or playing center field for the Yankees.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Both. And
it's not too late for the other two.
No, I'm thinking. You know, it's not too late. You know, I got a shot this year.
You got a shot.
But that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to play baseball or I wanted to play music.
Okay.
And I think I pursued the right one.
So probably.
You say you dreamed about it. Were you like actually dreaming the music, or were you just dreaming about being up on stage?
Just dream about being on stage and actually, I mean, imagine this, dreaming of playing the banjo. I mean, I love banjo and still love to play, still do play a lot. And and that strange dream kind of for a kid, you know?
Yeah.
Either playing shortstop or playing banjo. Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's true. It's true. Huh. And well, nothing pleased my dad more and my mom. They were so great to me. I started playing really early and, you know, and picked things up pretty fast, listening to, sitting in front of a record player, listening to Earl Scruggs and Alan Shelton, Don Reno, all my heroes mm-hmm. from that time, you yeah. know. And next thing I know, Jim and Jesse are coming to town, and or not to town. They played a little schoolhouse not too many miles away, and my dad took me out to the show. And
poof, you're a Virginia boy.
Wow, yeah. He takes me backstage. They listen to me, and, yeah, it happened kind of quickly. I mean, you know, he told them, he said, if you guys ever need a banjo player, you know, think about us. Give us a call.
Your dad said that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so it I guess I must have been 12 or 13 when the first time I played for them. I can't remember exactly. I know my dad could, but they hired me at 14.
Wow.
Jim did call and said, hey, we do need a banjo player. Can he go on the road with us? And my mom and dad trusted him. Great, great people, Jim and Jesse. And
Jim and Jesse McReynolds, we need to say for everybody listening.
Yeah, they were just, it was a wonderful experience for a kid to get to go on the road with not only great people, but just icons in bluegrass world of
yeah.
music, you know. So it was a great experience, and I treasure it. Mm. In fact, I got to see Jesse for a while today. He was doing a little thing out nearby, and it was great to see him. Always great to see him.
Well, obviously, you made a name for yourself as a banjo player, but also as a guitar player. How hard was that transition between the instruments for you?
Well, it really wasn't. It really wasn't that hard. I remember getting a little gut string guitar when I was traveling with Jim and Jesse, and I was just a huge fan of Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed. And right. I'd sit on the bus and all those miles, you know, when I'm trying to stay awake and ride shotgun. That's about all I could do to stay awake was sit and play guitar. And Jesse and I, then when Jim was driving, Jesse and I would jam constantly. And he loved guitar playing too. Jesse's a good guitar player.
Really?
And
so he kind of showed you some stuff then.
He showed
me
a few things, and I, you know, worked out things. Again, sit in front of a record player a lot.
Yeah.
With listening to Jerry and Chet, Glenn Campbell.
Right. Know,
which came in handy later on.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was something else that just fell into place from knowing how to play guitar. Yeah.
Well, and before we get into that, let's go back to when you're 14 years old, you get hired as a Virginia boy.
Sure.
Was that just like summer touring? Because you were still going to school.
It was for the most part summer touring, but I'd come up and do the Opry with them some on the weekends. And I had a great principal.
Really?
He was really, really good about it. He told me and told my folks, if he keeps his grades up, he can go anytime he wants. As long as he makes good grades, don't worry about it. If he needs to go out on the weekend or he needs to go for a few days out. And I kept my grades up, and so they never gave me a problem. You know,
wow.
I missed a little school here and there.
That's unheard of. That's amazing.
I give him a lot of credit. Mr. Mantell Clay, he was kind enough not to raise a – it wouldn't have done him any good because my daddy just said, hey, he's going to go anyway.
Yeah.
You know, but he was a nice man, and he understood that that's what I wanted to do and what I was able to do. And it was the right thing to do. You know, I can't diagram a sentence today, I don't think, anymore.
But, you know, who can?
I can still play Shuckin' the Corn.
There you go. Well, so, okay, so you're 14, you're 15, you're 16, and you're in Louisville. Mm-hmm. You're playing the Grand Ole Opry, which is one of the biggest stages on the radio, and it was, you go back to school. I mean, what were the kids, were they thinking that was something else, or were they into other things then?
Along about that time, you know, the Beatles were, you know, had just come along and all that stuff. So, you know, I can't say that banjo picking was at the height of popularity, yeah. but I had great schoolmates, and so many of them really, you know, really took a liking to what I did and encouraged me very much.
Yeah.
I can't say that they, you know, had it in their 8-track players or whatever.
Right.
The bluegrass all the time.
Sure.
But they were great about it. In fact, many of them, and later on as we go along in the story, you know, I'll tell you more about what some of them wrote in my yearbook.
Some of them saw the future. Some of them saw into the future.
They saw the future. They really did.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, talking about being on the road, I mean, as a 14-year-old, and you're in situations, even with great people like that in the bluegrass world, I'm guessing you probably witnessed a few things here and there that probably most kids don't when, you know, they're out working with adults and being in bars and all that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, you definitely grow up a little fast, you know, but I was so blessed to be around such good people, you know, there wasn't any.
So they kind of shielded you from some of that stuff?
Well, to a certain extent. They were shielded themselves. They just didn't.
Okay, gotcha.
They didn't partake in a lot of wildness or whatever, you know.
And also, bluegrass is, you're probably not playing the same places that Hank Williams is playing, the juke joints and
stuff
like that.
There weren't too many bars. I might remember playing one place that had some chicken wire, but I can't. But not too many of those. Too many of those with Jim and Jesse, you know.
So where did you play? I'm kind of curious, because is in the 60s. So
along that time, you know, that's when the festival scene started. Bluegrass festivals started up around then, and we played a lot of those.
Okay.
Pretty much all over the place, and we'd play, you know, we'd play theaters. We'd play. I can remember playing at drive-ins. You know, on top of the, you know, they right before the movie, a band gets up and you stand on. You literally. The stage is the top of the concession stand. I'm serious.
And let's all go to the movies.
With Jim and Jesse, and it was a blast. I mean, I wouldn't take anything for those
movies. Was there any sort of PA for that, or was it everybody listening through those little speakers in the window?
No, we'd set up a PA. Set up a PA, and the people would get out of their cars and sit on the hoods of the cars or whatever. It was a blast. You know, you don't even realize how much fun it was at the time. You know, when you're doing it and you're a kid, you know, things are, you know, kind of going slower at that point.
Right, you're in a hurry to get to the next thing.
But you're kind of in a hurry as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, what's next? What's next? What's next? And now you look back on it and go, man, we should have taken more pictures. You know?
Yeah.
But it was a great time, great experience.
Well, I want to talk about your high school friends that were fortune tellers, but I also, we only have about a minute before we take, why don't we take a break now?
Okay.
Because I want to,
sure.
I don't want to cut this story short. So
absolutely.
We're going to take a break. We're going to be back with more of Carl Jackson, but we'd like to remind you that this segment is brought to you by our very good friends at Toyota of Cool Springs. You know, Hino and I are both Toyota drivers. We love this dealership, and not only just as a dealership, but they got a great service department.
Oh, they really do. Yeah. Actually, I've taken our vehicle in there a number of times, and they're so great about not only doing things in a timely way, but making you comfortable while you're there. They got a nice little waiting room with food and coffee and a game room for the kids. So I, you know, had to take my kids a couple times, and they were totally entertained. So
you left them there, as a matter
of
fact.
Yeah, I came back a couple
mistaken.
Days later. They were
fine.
They hopped up on coffee, and
they'd sold a couple of cars.
Yeah,
and had a little commission check
commission
for Daddy.
Was nice. Yeah,
nice.
I introduced them to the concept of taxes right then and there. So.
Toyota of Cool Springs. Ask for George, the owner. He's going to take great care of you. On the web at toyotaofcoolsprings.com.
That's right. We're going to be back with a whole lot more of Carl Jackson here on the Music Row Show.
Yes, I ain't too diplomatic. I just never been the kind to go along. Just avoiding confrontation for the sake of confirmation. And I'll admit I tend to sing a different song. Sometimes you just can't be afraid to wear a different hat. If Columbus had been plotting, this old world might still be flat. Nothing venture, nothing gain. Sometimes you got to go against the grain.
Yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's Garth Brooks, of course, doing a tune called Against the Grain, co-written by our guest here this hour, Carl Jackson. I'm assuming co-written, or did you write?
Yes, co-written with my dear friends, Mr. Larry Cordell and Mr. Bruce Bouton.
Nice.
I'm exhausted just hearing that song.
Were you playing on that as well?
Actually, I was not playing on it. I was singing on it, though.
Sweet.
Singing harmony. Me and Larry were singing harmony on it.
Throwing that high lonesome tenor up there.
There you go.
So before the break, we were talking about your high school buddies.
Yeah.
And you had some of them that were kind of precognizant. They were fortune tellers in your yearbook. So tell us that story.
Well, along about 1967, 68, somewhere in there, I guess, right? No, what am I thinking here? Get the year just right. Anyway, the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour was really big right along there. About the time I was leaving Jim and Jesse, you know, going on with the Sullivan family for a while. And as a senior, you know, you have people sign your yearbook. Well, every year, but especially your senior year, a lot of people signed it. And the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour, I'll get this out in a minute, was a really big deal. Mm-hmm. And we all loved that show, you know. And so several of my schoolmates wrote in my yearbook, "See you on Glen Campbell one day." And the reason they did that was because when Glenn's show started, John Hartford first, and then later Larry McNeely would stand up in the audience and start playing "Gentle on My Mind." And that's how the show started, with a banjo.
Right.
And so the kids, you know, they just, well, they just, Carl plays banjo. So
yeah, so he's going to be on there.
You know, he's going to be on there one of these days. Well, they write this in there. I work about a year with the Sullivan family playing guitar, and then Keith Whitley, Jimmy Goodrow, Bill Rollins, and myself form a little group called the Country Store. And this happens in Columbus, Ohio. Well, Keith and I are sitting at the breakfast table there one morning while we've been rehearsing and stuff like that. We'd only been together about a week. And we look in the paper and we see that Glen Campbell's going to be at the Ohio State Fair. And Keith was a huge fan, too. Mm-hmm. And Keith and I were very, very good friends. And we both loved Glen Campbell very much. So we decided that we were going to go out to the show to see Glen Campbell.
Sure.
So we did. The show was incredible. Glen was just at the peak, you know, right then. He was the biggest thing in America, you know. And so after the show, Keith and I went out to the Midway for a while and goofed around. And then we're on our way back to the car, past the dressing rooms, which were trailers,
right?
You know, and I look over and I see Larry McNeely standing there. He's talking to some folks backstage.
And that's Glen Campbell's banjo player.
That was Glenn's banjo player, who had played with Roy Acuff previously.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walked over and he got through talking to whoever he was talking to, signed an autograph or whatever. And I just walked up to him and I put my hand out and I said, "Larry, I'm Carl Jackson. I just wanted to say hello to you and tell you how much I enjoyed the show." And he said, "Carl Jackson." He said, "I know you." He said, "Man, I love your playing. What are you doing here?" So I told him the whole story, you know, and he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, just hanging out with the guys, you know, and we're up here doing a little rehearsing, going to do a little recording." And he said, "Well, won't you come by tomorrow and let's do some picking?" And I said, "Okay, I will." So I did. And when I first got in there, I noticed that, you know, Larry got his banjo out and I got mine out, and but he kept asking me to play things. You know, he said, "Can you play this?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay. Can you play this?" "Yeah." Uh-huh. I said, "Well, do you play guitar?" And I said, "Yeah, I play guitar." And all of a sudden, he just looked over at me and he said, "Would you like to have this job? Seriously?" And I said, "Yeah, what do you mean?"
"What job?"
Yeah, yeah. He said, "I don't want to travel anymore." He said, "I've been looking for somebody that can replace me." And he said, "You can do it." He said, "If you want this job, give me a few minutes." I'm like, "Okay."
A few minutes.
So literally he walks out of that trailer, goes to Glenn's trailer, comes back about 3 or 4 minutes later, and he said, "Come with me." And so he walks me into Glenn's dressing room.
Oh, man.
And there sits my idol, you know, Glen Campbell. And so he puts me through the same routine, basically, you know, as "So you play banjo?" "Yeah, play banjo." You know, and, "Well, can you play this?" You know, "Foggy Mountain Breakdown." "Can you play Rocky Top?" "Can you play all this stuff?" You know, mm-hmm. whatever. And I'm playing them for him. And then he says, "Well, do you play guitar?" And I said, yeah, I do. And I, at that time, pretty well knew everything he'd ever done because I just loved him.
Right.
And so I played some guitar stuff for him. And he looked over at me and he said, "How much you want to make?" and the 18-year-old kid in me came out and I said, "I want to make $1 million."
Yeah, sure.
He said, "No problem. Just go home and get your stuff together and we'll call you next week or so, and you got the gig."
Man.
So that's the way it happened. So the kids in the yearbook were pretty smart.
That's an amazing story.
It's absolutely true. I could show you the year. I still got them.
I was watching a YouTube video of him and Glenn playing the dueling banjos.
Yeah.
And you look like a kid. I mean,
I was a kid.
You look like maybe 18, 19 years old.
I was 18 when I went with Glenn, or almost 19. It was right before I turned 19, because I remember having my 19th birthday party right before I moved out to California, right after I'd taken the job.
And you should have seen, I don't know if you saw the video, but he's smiling and winking at the audience. I mean, man.
He's like a pro.
He's got some savvy, but he'd been playing since 8 years old. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm just curious, doing the TV show, as a musician, how is that gig different from a normal show, doing the TV thing?
You know, the Glenn show you're talking about?
Just in general,
Much TV happened, but now the Good Time Hour had actually gone off before I went with Glenn, so I was never on the Good Time Hour.
Okay.
That was John and Larry, but then we did tons of TV after that.
Sure.
And it is a lot different from... from live shows, obviously. But we had a regular show in England for a while. We had a regular show, a syndicated show over here for a while. And then, I mean, we were always doing The Tonight Show and Merv Griffin, stuff like that. So got used to doing a lot of TV back in those days.
Just because a lot of times on TV shows, at least it used to be, you know, the sound was just not ever that great. And I'm just curious, how is it in the room when you're there? I mean, how...
Never great.
Never great? Yeah. Why is that, you think?
Gosh, it's just nature of the beast, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not as... I tell you, one of the toughest ones now is doing the Letterman show. You know,
really?
He keeps it so cold in there. He keeps it...
Instruments are going out of tune.
Oh, yeah. It's like 48 degrees. He says it keeps the audience on their toes. You know, it sure does. Like, hey, it's cold in there. But I don't know. It was... Again, you don't think about stuff like that. It was I remember Glenn, he actually got me a guest spot myself on the Carson show and on the Merv Griffin show and on Jack Parr the year that he came back on, a year or two he came back on for a while. And as a solo guest, because I had we'd done a banjo album and Glenn, he got me spots on there, and it was really cool.
That's pretty cool of him to do, yeah.
To do those shows, and a lot of them with him, but to get to come out and, you know, have Johnny just say, thank you, Carl. I mean, that was kind of nice. So. you know, you're always the last spot on this show. Thank you, Carl, for being here. Okay,
yeah, good night.
That was enough.
Enough. Yeah. Well, talk about what kind of education 12 years with Glenn Campbell was.
Fantastic. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there's never been a better singer than Glenn Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Never. He's just the best. I mean, I see TV shows that we did now all those years ago, and believe me, there was no Pro Tools then.
Right.
And he sounds like he's been Pro Tooled. I mean, the guy was a laser beam. I mean, he was just unbelievable how great he could sing and play guitar, obviously. But,
well, and just performing in general. I mean, what did you learn performing, watching him while on stage with him?
I think a lot of stuff learned just by... not even realizing you're learning it, just being close to such a pro like that. One thing was he made me a much better singer, I believe, because I had, you know, I sang all the harmony parts above him, you know, and he was
up there.
Hi, I'm Glenn Campbell. You know, helped me get to where I could sing a little tenor every now and then. But it was great to watch him and to learn guitar things from him. Just learn how comfortable he was, you know, with the audience and everything. He was great.
Yeah.
And Glenn was always that way wherever he was, you know. We'd go out to eat somewhere and it didn't bother Glenn for people to come up and ask him for an autograph. He was always so gracious to him. Just a good, good man. Another just example of God putting me in the right place, you know, like the Jim and Jesse thing. And all of a sudden there's Glenn Campbell, and you couldn't ask to be with a better guy.
That's great. We'd love to hear a song.
I'd love that. Yeah. You feel like playing something for us?
I'll try.
You know, I mean, do you play guitar?
Yeah. Do you play guitar?
Do you play guitar?
Isn't that what they were asking? I don't know.
I mean, can you play the guitar?
See what I can do here.
There we go.
A lot of times I'll do this song here for a couple of different reasons. One, because when I moved out to California and went with Glenn back in 1972, I remember my mom giving me quite a hard time about not writing home enough. You know, it was kind of expensive to call home a lot.
Oh, sure.
Know, back then. So, and I wasn't very good at writing letters. So I got this wild idea one day that I would write her and my dad and my sister a song, you know, to try to make it up to them. And I wrote this tune here. And the other cool part about it is that Glenn recorded it in 1984.
Oh, wow.
And it became the first top 10 country record I'd ever had. Another one of those things, you know.
Wow.
Just kind of fell into place. And so I'll try to do it for you.
All right.
Call Letter to Home. You might think there's some big reason I took the time to write cards and letters. There've been too few of those. I just stopped to realize how long that I've been gone, and there's a few small things I need to know. Dear Daddy, do the whippoorwills still echo through the night? Does the sound of silence squeeze a morning light? Has Granddad caught the big one in the pond just down the road? I miss you so. Time keeps right on slipping by me, like the miles out on the road. But I don't guess I'll change my way of life. There's no harm in holding memories. Please tell me if you can. I need to bring those old times into sight. Dear Mama, can you still find the dipper in the stars? Do the roads still go for hours without cars? Does the frost still shine cold mornings on the grass outside the door? Just like before, tell me more. Is sis still planning marriage sometime soon? Can you still reach out and almost touch the moon? Do the old songs still ring out through the hills for days and days? Love always. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, wow, wow.
Right, man. Man,
I call my mom.
Yeah, I need to call my mom too. Why don't we go ahead and take a quick break? Where we're going to come back definitely with a whole lot more of Carl Jackson here on the Music Row Show.
Well, the good Lord said November 30, back in 1835. By the way, he will arrive. When the doctor spanks that little bottom and this newborn baby cries, let a light shine bright up here in heaven, leave a trail across the sky.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That, of course, is the great Ricky Skaggs doing Comet Ride, which was written or co-written by our guest here this hour.
I actually wrote that one by myself.
You wrote that one by yourself. Awesome. written by Carl Jackson, yeah. Comet Ride.
Well, let's talk about that, because you're playing, you're supporting Glenn Campbell, you're doing your own banjo albums. At what point does songwriting start to become more important in your world, and who were your mentors?
Well, I started writing back before I went with Glenn.
Yeah.
Well, the first things I wrote were instrumentals, obviously, banjo instrumentals as a kid. But then I started writing some songs with lyrics, but I didn't get up my nerve to really show things to anybody until Glenn.
Okay.
And after I got with Glenn, I finally showed him a few things that I'd written, and he's like, man, these are really good. I like these. Why don't we do a record? So I actually did another record on Capitol, which was this wow mishmash of stuff, you know, all the way from pop stuff to bluegrass stuff to, you know, it was just whatever.
Just the things labels love, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was listening to the Eagles back then. I was listening to Elton John back then a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, bluegrass was just buried inside me, you know.
Right.
So it was, but it gave me confidence, you know, to have Glenn Campbell tell me, hey, I like this stuff and I want to, let's do an album on this and I want to sign you to my publishing company.
Wow.
And all that stuff. So I have to give Glenn a lot of that credit, you know. And then when I moved back to Nashville, 1980, 1981, right in there, I stayed with Glenn until 84.
Mm-hmm.
But I moved back to Nashville. And right before I left Glenn, like I say, he cut Letter to Home, you know, that I played for you there. I had written it quite a few years before. But I remember calling him. We were in Australia or somewhere. And I had given him another tape with Letter to Home on. And he called me. He was crying. He said, man, this song just kills me. He said, I'm going to record this. And I said, man, well, that's nice. I wish you would, you know. So he did in 84, you know. And it was, you know, it was a top 10 country record. So
yeah.
it was biggest hit I'd ever had at the time as a songwriter. And once again, there's Glenn Campbell opening doors for me.
Wow.
You know? And then I just stayed at it, you know, and kept writing and been very blessed to have so many good people cut songs, you know.
Yeah.
And it's something I love to do.
That's
well,
great.
In when you're writing, stylistically speaking, what are the differences between writing a good bluegrass song and a good country song, for example? Do you have a different mindset going in?
I don't really go into a songwriting session with a different mindset ever. I go in trying to write the best song I possibly can. You know, now sometimes if you're writing with an artist you can point yourself in a direction to write a certain kind of song,
mm-hmm.
but I don't like to just box myself in to something and limit myself on how
okay.
something can be, because you never really know, you know, how a song's going to go.
Right.
You
yeah.
know? And I just, I don't think about it that way. I think there are all kinds of songs that, you know, that certainly weren't written as bluegrass songs that make wonderful bluegrass songs and
okay.
vice versa. You know,
yeah.
A great song is a great song. It really is, and you can perform it a lot of different ways, a lot of different arrangements. So that's
great.
Kind of the way I go about
that.
My songwriting.
I love that.
I don't really go sit down and go, I'm going to write a bluegrass song today. A lot of songs that I've written that were written as country songs have
yeah.
been recorded in the bluegrass world too. So
that's actually something I love to do is some songs that have been recorded a lot, and you
mm-hmm.
go and you research online and you can hear, like you said, a jazz version, a country
Absolutely.
Version of all the same song. And it's just
Absolutely.
Kind of fun to hear how different people take the same thing and
it's really
do their
cool
thing.
To see how people interpret a song.
Well, a great example of that is that Bonnie Raitt tune, I Can't Make You Love Me If You... And that
yeah.
started out as a fast bluegrass tune.
Yeah.
That's how it was originally written.
Yeah.
So
what a wonderful tune.
It's all right.
Alan
Mike Reed will squash you
yeah,
like
would.
A bug
with one hand.
With one hand.
And Alan Chamberlain will hit you after that.
That's yeah, right, exactly. Once you're down. Is patience important for you as a songwriter? I mean, how do you deal with when you feel like you got a good one on the line, but it's just not quite coming?
I think it's immensely important. I really do. I mean, I do not believe in forcing the issue on a song. I don't believe in, we've got to finish this today, and if it's not finished, it's not finished.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to settle on anything. You know, if the house isn't built, if you don't have the roof on it, you know, it's going to leak.
That's true.
You know, and I don't do that. Many, many times, many songs, I mean, I've got songs in my notebook right now that aren't finished. Believe me, they just, you know, it might hit me for a while and I work on it and like get kind of stuck on it or whatever, but I always go back to it. And I try not to settle, you know, and that's just my take on it. That's probably kept me from I've never been one to write, you know, tons of songs a year, whatever. I always would write, you know, 15, 20 songs a year, even during my staff writer days. Mm-hmm. You know, but I tried my best to make it 15 or 20 good ones, you know, and get a bigger percentage of them cut, you know, rather than throwing a lot against the wall. You right. know, I got an appointment this morning. I got one this afternoon. I got to write two songs. I just never did that. I never liked doing that. I'm not saying that it can't be done that way, but that's just kind of the approach I have, is to take my time on it.
Right.
You know, if it's a co-write and you have to get back together, then we just get back together. You know, sometimes that's over the phone. I remember Pam Tillis and I, we wrote Put Yourself in My Place, you know, and we got together. We wrote the first verse together, and then in the same room. And I think we wrote the second one over the phone or something, you know. I mean, you do what you what you have to do, but you get it done. You know?
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to take one more break. We're here with hit songwriter Carl Jackson, and we'll be back in just a few minutes on the Music Row Show.
Well, I sit here alone about midnight, so darn lonesome, not a soul in sight.
Oh, yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show.
Paps out drinking.
That's Brad Paisley doing Huck Finn Blues. Co-written by our guest here this hour, Carl Jackson. And we actually want to give a little shout out to Molly Jean listening out there. We actually saw you.
Hey,
we saw her play at the Smoky Mountain Songwriter Festival, and you were awesome, Molly. So
absolutely,
we Molly loved that
great.
A lot.
She is just special.
Yeah,
glad she's listening. I'm glad that she's getting snowed in so she can stay up late.
Yeah,
that's good news. well, Carl, you wanted to play a little something special.
Yeah, I'm gonna. I've got a guitar album out that my dad and mom wanted me to do for many years, and. Thought I'd do a little something from that. It's called Grace Notes. And,
yeah.
Thought I'd do something for my dad. I know he's listening out there. And
by the way, how do people buy your music?
You can get on carljackson.net,
mm-hmm.
Directly on the website, or you know, on Amazon, iTunes. That album is the latest thing of just myself, and it's an all instrumental hymn album.
Okay.
Played 12 different guitars, and it's an idea my dad. Encouraged me to do for so many years, and I'm finally glad to get it out. So
awesome.
Thought I'd play a couple things off of that or something.
Goodness,
man!
Thank you.
Woo!
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm gonna go home tonight and apologize to my guitar.
Thank you very much.
Wow! Well, we had a listener. Where is she? Listener Robin saying we'd like to hear him talk about the Bristol Project.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yes. Hey, tell us about the Bristol Project.
All right.
Good question, Hino.
Yeah, I don't know where I came up with that.
Oh, you know, to kind of shorten the story, years ago I did a tribute record to the Leuven Brothers
right.
in 2003.
Right.
I did a, back in just about 3 years ago now, I did a project honoring Mark Twain,
right.
Mark Twain Words and Music. And now my dear friend, Mr. Rusty Morrell over in Bristol, asked me if I would take on a project to honor the 1927 Bristol Sessions. Or the Big Bang of country music.
Right, right.
Along the same lines of the Mark Twain Project, where it's like it's in words and music. I've got the great Eddie Stubbs, by the way, narrating the project.
Oh, wow.
And so many great artists from Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton, Brad Paisley, Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver,
nice.
Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers. Anyway, a bunch of wonderful artists doing remakes of the original songs that were done on the Bristol Sessions in 27. And then in between each song, Eddie tells the story of how that all came together. And I'm so proud of it. Emmylou's doing Bury Me Beneath the Willow. Dolly's doing When They Ring Those Golden Bells that I just played there.
Oh, wow.
It's just... so proud of the project, and it's been about 2 years in the making. Hopefully going to be out in the June, July area, somewhere in there. It was actually supposed to come out in October, but it's just gotten a little bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
There's more people added to it, and
that's
we're
a good
so
thing.
Proud of it and just happy that it's...
Can I make a request?
Absolutely.
When that does come out, will you come back? Because
absolutely.
Something we have not spent any time talking about with you this hour is Carl Jackson, the producer.
I would love
and
to come back and talk about that.
We would things. Love to hear about that and hear songs from this. So when
and
it's
if you
done,
could bring all of those folks with you,
sure,
that'd be great.
Yeah. They'll all be lined up.
Except
you know.
For Eddie. For some reason, this is his one night off. Trying to get him here just isn't going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, no. He did such a great job. Though.
Oh man, I
can't wait to hear that.
It's a fun project. It's really, really lots of hard work, but it's a labor of love.
So, if one has a case of Red Bull and a free 72 hours,
right,
one could go on YouTube and watch videos of Carl playing music with pretty much everybody. So, who haven't you made music with that you'd still like to?
Oh, wow. I'm sure there's plenty of them out there, and I want to make music with all of them. How's that? That's
good. How's Tuesday?
I have really been blessed to be able to sing and to play and to write for, to produce so many great acts. Yeah. Oh my goodness, getting to work with James Taylor and on How's the World Treating You with Alison Krauss was just a joy, and there's. Yeah, you know, like there I go singling something out, but that was just a great experience to get to work with James. I always loved his playing and singing.
Yeah.
And gosh, it just goes on and on. My my heroes, you know, getting to sing with Dolly.
Yeah, see, I wanted
to. Getting to sing with Emmy Lou, getting to sing with, you know, travel and sing with Linda Ronstadt.
Producing Merle. I mean, we got lots to talk about. You got to come back.
I'll be happy to come back.
Okay.
All absolutely. Right. We're going to hold you to that because, you know, people say that and then.
We never hear from most people again.
I'll come back. I'll say right here. I'm looking in the camera. I'll come back.
Okay, now wait a minute. Monday nights at the Station
Monday
Inn.
Monday nights, the Station Inn. Every Monday night, myself, Larry Cordell, Val Story, the great Aubrey Haney playing Phil.
Nice.
The great Doug Jernigan playing Steel. The great Mike Bubb playing bass. The great Larry Adamanuk playing drums. The great Catherine Marks playing keyboards.
Can't miss that.
And I throw in a little guitar, and Larry, Val, and I do all the singing, and it's just, we have a blast.
Oh, okay. every Monday night at the Station Inn.
What time?
9 o'clock every Monday night.
Get there by 6 or you won't get in.
CarlJackson.net.
CarlJackson.net.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And hey, everybody out there, thanks that you're listening to us. And we'll see you next week on the Music Row Show.